a second-by-second guide to keeping your audience up to date with the very latest changes.
This is Peter Porter reporting.
Our reporter Peter Porter there reporting live this morning. And we'll keep you up to date with the very latest developments as they happen. But now with the time at 16, and we interrupt this time check to go straight back now for a live report from our reporter Peter Porter. Peter, can you tell us what's happened in the last 12?
Well, yes, I've had about one sip of coffee and taken about three breaths.
Yes, it must be breathtaking stuff indeed.
Well, I can't confirm that at the moment, but it does look pretty much that way.
Peter, can you tell us what the atmosphere's like?
Well, it's about 80% nitrogen, 16% oxygen, 4% carbon.
Our reporter Peter Porter. Now news of the primate. And we interrupt this word to go straight back now live to our reporter, Peter Porter. Peter, can you tell us what's... Plus, handy hints on that absolute obligation to charge every dispatch with that atmospheric, in the thick of it, action dynamic. The Broadcast Journalist's Guide to Reporting the Demise of the Iron Curtain.
Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. From our People's Republic of Stokes Croft, Ministry of Propaganda Studios. In the second hour, the censorship is definitely the theme. The American Frontline Doctors press conference outside the US Capitol building is censored on Wednesday by YouTube, Twitter and Facebook, all at the same time, after receiving around 20 million views. So let's have a listen to their dangerous words. And also, Mohsin Saeed Abbas is a TV journalist who had his Facebook account suspended this week for comments about an Israeli army patrol attacking a disabled Palestinian man who was in a wheelchair. We'll speak to him about the mechanisms behind this kind of censorship. And 2 years ago, in the European Parliament, Bulgarian investigative journalist Diliana Gitancheva exposed a secret US military bioweapons program in Georgia and elsewhere around the world. But her questions were disallowed in the parliament, and then she was banned from the European Parliament building for asking questions of a US representative who's being quizzed there. Could she have uncovered a biowarfare conspiracy that we're now seeing unfold before our eyes? The censorship is coming into the open now, but what about in the past? Have basic ideas like creation or intelligent design been censored over the decades? Has the spiritual also been the target in a decades-long psychological warfare operation? Well, that's all in the second hour after six, but joining me to review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
You're coughing a little bit there. You haven't got the COVID, have you, this week?
I hope not.
Good. There was a bit more news this week about here in Bristol, particularly, the problem with bins. So another article about this. Can you say something about the way that basic public services have been slowly denuded over the last, well, particularly since the 2008 financial crisis and the election of the Tories in 2010?
Well, local government has been denuded before that. It goes back to the 1980s. And it's partly financial and it's partly institutional. So they haven't got the powers they need to do the things they need to do.
Here in Bristol, we've got an arm's-length company, they call it, that's been created. It's now, I believe, it's doing three or four different types of things. One of which is housing, another is Bristol Waste, and the other is Bristol Energy. Now, all three seem to be rather disastrous. We've had a massive overspend of hundreds of thousands of pounds by Bristol Waste, and we know something like £40 million been spent, good money, throwing good money after bad with Bristol Energy. So it doesn't really seem to be working, does it?
Well, I mean, you've got specific projects like that in Bristol, which there are specific questions about how well managed they have been.
Yeah, but there's all sorts of similar projects in other parts of the country.
Well, you've also got the basic problem of outsourcing, and you can see that in relation to the test and trace regime. In Germany and other countries, they've actually used their health infrastructure to carry out test and trace. The Tory government here has decided to hand it over to Serco and various other Capita and other, you know, generalised companies who basically don't even have skilled staff. They're just basically recruiting people who've got no background in that particular field, and then they're expecting them to, from scratch, create a system. And that's what's been going on for years. Basically, it destroys the lines of accountability. So, you know, when local councils ran things, you knew if something was wrong, you knew who to complain to. But you've now got, basically, jobs for the boys, contracting out, much of which is actually more inefficient than actually doing it in-house. But this is going to come to a head, because the government's promised that it will support local authorities who are going to be undermined by the recession that's coming round the corner. But of course, local authorities have got to balance their books, as have the devolved governments in Scotland and Wales. And Northern Ireland, they've got to balance the books, but they get loads of subsidy. And they haven't got the capacity to respond to the crisis that we're facing. That's because it's been denuded over many, many years, and it's not just since the 2008 crisis. Although, of course, the things that should have been done then weren't done. And lots of things have been done that shouldn't have been done, and we're now in a very difficult position. Local authorities effectively are going to go bankrupt unless they get more money from central government. But then if more money comes from central government, which is not even clear they're going to give any, it may be a situation where they then basically can control what local government can and can't do.
Okay, well, we did talk about this a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? But the latest articles yesterday on the BBC Bristol homepage, which is racism and neglect are blamed for St Paul's rubbish blight. Institutionalised neglect and racism have left streets in parts of Bristol filled with rubbish and fly-tipping reports ignored, residents say. One homeowner from St Paul's alleged a waste contractor call handler told her the area was never going to be great because it has lots of ethnic minorities. Bristol Waste said it did not recognise the claims on any level.
Well, I mean, the idea that this is what happens in the States. They say, look at all the cities, they're controlled by the Democrats, and this is where all the crime and disorder and poor living conditions are, and that's because they vote Democrat. It isn't. It's because that's where the poor live, and the poor tend to vote Democrat,
but
therefore the problems of poverty are the one.
But this is a Labour city, isn't it? So
Martin,
you would have thought that if it's a Labour administration, it would be the rich Tory voting areas where things like this would happen. But the thing is, with the Labour as it is at the moment, it doesn't really seem to be catering for its own voters.
Well, the problem is that the poor create more demand of social services and other services than the wealthy. I mean, the wealthy only ever get from what they get from the council. Somebody collects their bin and that's it. Other people require intervention of social workers and so on. The problems are concentrated in the inner cities. The wealth is concentrated in the suburbs. But the problem isn't an inner city problem. The problem is the greed and selfishness of the political authorities, which basically represent the already privileged and are not prepared to make the resources available to change living conditions for the poor.
People living in the area accused Bristol City Council and Bristol Waste of dismissing concerns simply because of where they live. They said streets were filled with vermin, litter and overflowing bins, and suffered frequent fly tipping. Catherine Jordan, who's 44, claimed when she called Bristol Waste to complain, she was told people who lived in an ethnically diverse area were more laid back about the state of the street. She said the street is awful, and she talked about that and how damaging it is for everyone that lives there. And she said, I really do wonder about how I've never seen any scenes like this in the wealthier areas of the city. The call handler said, oh, well, it's different in Montpellier and St Paul's. They're just so much more laid back about that kind of stuff. She said something along the lines of, recalling a conversation, that the cultural diversity, the ethnicity means basically it's always going to be somewhere that people dump rubbish because not everyone has the same standards. Well, it's almost implying that ethnic minorities are rubbish.
Well, I mean, that's basically just racist codswallop.
This is for Bristol Waste, right? Bristol Waste coming up with this stuff, one of the call handlers, and yet they're saying, oh, well, we don't recognise any kind of racism in our procedures at all. But then there's one of their call handlers apparently coming out with it.
Well, I mean, the call handler is obviously expressing their basically racist codswallop opinions. The fundamental problem is that poor people find it difficult to, you know, going to the dump requires having a car or a truck or something similar. And of course, in the past, the council used to come and pick up stuff. You just phone up and they come and take it. Now, in order to save money, you've got to pay to have it picked up. And of course, poor people think, well, I haven't got any money to pay for this, so they fly to it. And of course, wealthier people, they've got more money. And well, then in Clifton, they don't fly to it.
Well, let me tell you as well that once fly tipping starts, commercial businesses that are up against it for one way or another, maybe because of the lockdown, they also will be using that area to fly tip, because they'll see it as a sort of Trojan horse, and they say, well, if anyone can fly tip around here, we're going to have to do it too.
Well, that's right. And of course, if there's what you might call low-level fly tipping going on, same problem in Eastern, then other people will drive in from outside and dump their stuff there, because that's a good place to dump it.
Well, this is the second article in a few weeks about the racism, basically, towards poor areas like St Paul's. It's not a very good record for Britain's first mixed-race mayor, Marvin Rees, the Labour, so-called Labour guy, is it?
Well, I mean, the person who actually dealt with the phone call will have to justify what they said to their line manager.
No, but there's a pattern here, Martin, the fly-tipping and the rubbish everywhere in a mainly black area.
Yeah, but I don't think you can blame directly the city council. Does have a responsibility here, clearly, but the problems are endemic. I mean, the problems of poor areas like St Paul's, where we're sitting now, are not just that the council's racist, although that may be the case. Poor people round here are on universal credit. Nothing to do with the council, and universal credit is rubbish. Causes all kinds of problems. Homelessness, food banks, that's all directly down to Ian Duncan Smith and the rules around universal credit. And the council hasn't got any power over that whatsoever. So it's all very well to say that the council's responsible. The council cannot be the way capitalism works, the way the housing system works, all of it is rigged against the people who live in St Paul's and has been rigged for decades. And the council, of course, can be part of the problem and not part of the solution. But underlying all of this is that local authorities don't have any power. They've got no power over planning. They're basically a talking shop. And that's the problem. And of course, you've got more power in some parts of the country, like in Scotland, they've got a national parliament. And in Northern Ireland, they've got an assembly. But even so, they don't have much power. During the furlough and the lockdown, Scottish Parliament has got to balance the books. They haven't got the power to borrow money so that they could carry out their own policy. Ultimately, of course, what the SNP want is independence. And then they can borrow their own money and they can have their own policy. But of course, it's absolutely impossible in inner city areas in mainland England, because the power has been taken to the centre and then basically distributed to the supporters of the regime, who are in the City of London and the wealthy suburbs.
Well, staying with the local area, Bristol has lost a legend. Tributes paid to the owner of a late-night blues bar. Celebrations took place earlier this year to remember nights they'd had at the Shabeen, it was called. This is on the Bristol Post. The man who ran the last Shabeen in the southwest, who's described as a cornerstone of the St Paul's community, has died. Gilbert Watson, known as Ajax, died on Sunday, July the 19th, after being diagnosed with cancer. Mr Watson was described as the life and soul of the party, having become well known for his operating the Shady Grove Cafe, opening it in 1970, creating a safe haven for the African Caribbean community in St Paul's to dance, drink and socialise. It quickly became the heart of the area, and so did he. In the 1990s, St Paul's had several after-hours blues clubs, and it became a centre of the free party scene. Earlier this year, many of Mr Watson's loved ones got together in celebration of him and paid tribute to his Shabeen, being the last one in the southwest. Ajax, this is, Martin. Now, this is a glowing tribute to Ajax, and that's fine, but certainly my experience of the place has been not quite so rosy. Anyway, what's your thoughts about Ajax's place? It was on Ashley Road, wasn't it?
Well, I've never been there, but I mean, it's got a fairly mixed reputation, as you say. And I don't know. Some people obviously got something out of going there. Other people, it was always, you know, on the edge of the law. And I don't know enough about it to have a strong opinion, I have to be honest.
And certainly my experience of chatting to people about it, and my own feeling that it wasn't really the place for me. Obviously, it's one of the places you pay some money to go in, basically. You pay a little bit on the door. Quite a lot of muggings took place in there as well. And there seemed to be a bit of a different attitude towards white girls and white blokes, where white girls are very much welcomed, but white men were more likely to get mugged. So it doesn't seem to me that the Bristol Post is really reflecting the criminal aspect of what was going on there, even though, of course, it was, you know, quite a good place to go if you were one of the regular clientele.
Well, as I say, Tony, I could say all sorts of things, but it's just gossip, isn't it? You know.
Well, certainly for me, it isn't. It's speaking to people directly who were mugged in there. I mean, this is over the last 15 years, I suppose. I've been living in the city. I quite often spoke. People would say, "Oh, I'm not going in there again." You know, last time I got threatened and nearly beaten up, I had to hand over contents of my wallet, and then I left.
Well, I mean, there's all sorts of stories about all sorts of things going on. I mean, I don't really think there's much point us gossiping about it here and now. You know, the guy's died. Some people are unhappy about that, and they want, they remember the good times they've had there. I don't really know enough about it to argue with you, Tom.
This side of our culture, I suppose, the idea here is that, you know, there are clubs and there are criminal things that go on in the big nightclubs too, aren't there? I mean, this isn't just places like this, and I think there is definitely some sort of a criminal underworld working within many of these places, and I suppose it's because they were outside the law in terms of the licensing of the place. That is, I suppose, can create a Trojan horse to allow more criminality to creep in. And that's not just, I'm not just pointing the finger at Ajax by any means, but, you know, other places too. The big clubs, the more, you know, ones with the big budgets and big, I mean, I'm thinking about things like the Lakota. And we've just seen that lady from one of the Lakota owners, going to join the Merchant Venturers. But there's definitely, you know, drug dealing goes on within there, that place, and they have their own, I don't know whether they're official, but they certainly seem to be drug dealers, deals taking place within those joints.
Well, the whole drugs laws are a farce, Tony, as you well know, and that creates criminality makes criminals of all sorts of people who wouldn't be criminals if the laws were different. And Bristol's no different from many other major cities in this respect, in this country or elsewhere. And unless it's one of the things we really need to do is reform the drug laws. And of course, Thangham Debonair, as a local MP here, has actually been quite outspoken about that. And, you know, it's because, you know, places like Bristol would benefit from changes in the drug laws, which would decriminalise a lot of behaviour, which then basically becomes safe or safer than it currently is.
Well, down the other end of Ashley Road, on Grosvenor Road, of course, there was another blues club, not totally unlike Ajax's, called the Crystal Dove, on Grosvenor Road. And that was where the mayor's father, he ran that, Valentine Walker, didn't he? It's a similar sort of an organisation. And that we'll be talking a bit more about that next week. Because this is a topic which is very sensitive in the city, because obviously the mayor's father, being a kind of equivalent to Ajax at the other end of the front line, running the club called the Crystal Dove, is certainly of interest to quite a lot of people. Certainly, I mean, it's of interest because he was involved, allegedly anyway, in getting rid of the anti-apartheid movement in the city. A guy called Balagoon, who we interviewed a couple of years ago, Martin.
Yeah, and you've got to also recognise that Marvin was largely brought up shelters and so on, because he basically, his mother split with his father many, many years ago, and he has virtually nothing to do with it. So, you know, the idea that you can paint all this on to Marvin is...
I'm certainly not doing that, and I'm saying
he's rather unfair.
From a criminal family. I mean, I think we just need to be honest about it.
Well, no, his father was definitely involved in criminal activity in the city, but Marvin had very little to do with him. He was brought up by his mother, who is basically a Welsh nursery teacher, and extremely responsible and respected member of the community. And, of course, Marvin himself, as you know, is a regular churchgoer and has nothing to do with criminal elements.
Well, he's a lay preacher, isn't he, at Christchurch Clifton, which is a, you know, that's certainly part of what he does. And he's also very connected to that Christian scene. His mum, apparently, when he became mayor at the inauguration ceremony, said that she thought that God had wanted Marvin to win.
Well, I mean, I can't make any comment on that, but you'll understand that, you know, his personal life is very much not in that mould that you were talking about earlier. And you know, you've got to recognise that it's, you know, like father, like son is not necessarily the case, is it?
Anyway, we've got more info and news this week about Bristol. And before we go to look at COVID, I thought we ought to listen to a chap called Robin Campbell. He was interviewed by somebody called Anna Breeze. She's a former BBC journalist that's been doing quite a lot of internet interviews. The idea really being that if people find that they can't get their news out through the London media of various sorts, or even their own local media, come to Anna and she will interview you and put the interview up on YouTube. So let's have a listen now to Robin Campbell. He's 52 years old, and as we begin our look at the COVID-19 censorship and crisis this week, and the first week of the compulsory wearing of masks in shops, supposedly compulsory anyway, then let's have a listen to Robin Campbell. He's 52 year old, and he's an IT consultant from Bristol.
My name's Robin Campbell from Bristol, age 52, and have four children. I'm an IT consultant, and I've been studying this pandemic since it broke, getting more and more suspicious as time got on. But I'll give you some things that I found out during this time. Somebody I know manages the waiting list at the Bath Royal Infirmary, and she said that there's been only 13 cases at the maximum, and the waiting list for everything else has gone skyrocketing. I also know someone who's a consultant, an NHS worker in Bristol, who supports the doctors and the hospitals. And she's been laid off. She's doing one day a week. And she says the hospitals have been empty. She said the surgeries are empty. And she just wants to get involved, but obviously can't. Then I know someone who I walk the dog with, whose husband works at the Nightingale Hospital. That's the emergency one set up at University of the West of England. Again, wasn't kitted out with all the right equipment and has been empty ever since. My concerns have been around the timing of lockdowns and the timing of all the announcements. The Neil Ferguson projections, 550,000 on March the 19th, got downgraded shortly afterwards, didn't they? After the lockdown had been secured, and we should have lifted the lockdown at that point. Then we're supposed to be locking down for further to save the NHS. We clearly got into April and there was no need to keep the lockdown going. We'd saved the NHS. And then I interviewed two doctors. I have a small YouTube channel. I interviewed two UK doctors who came out with all the same information that people are waking up to now. That is, the virus was not isolated using the right science. The tests are 80%, giving 80% false positives and can't be relied on. People were getting referred from hospitals into care homes and causing mayhem and loads of extra unnecessary deaths. People are missing their treatments and surgeries. These two doctors are very experienced surgeons in the world of cancer, and they're so concerned a lot of their patients are not getting seen. They are also concerned about the excess deaths that are likely to come through things that are byproducts of lockdown, so depression, alcohol abuse, drug abuse, domestic violence, and like I've said, missed treatments in their surgeries, and missed tests and things. They're also concerned about the influence of big money and big pharma and the vaccine companies influencing all the policy that our governments are listening to. So we not only had the bad numbers from Imperial College, but we had the big money also saying we should track and trace and we should vaccinate everyone. Thankfully in Bristol, we just done a Bristol Live survey, and I think there's about 9,000 or 10,000 people surveyed. 46% have said no to a mandatory vaccine. That's really encouraging. And I've also just watched the Breitbart doctors in America, the Breitbart.com press release with about 8 or 9 doctors all coming out and saying there is a cure, a safe cure. I won't quote it here because I don't want your channel marked down for it, but go to Breitbart.com and go and see these amazing doctors explaining what they found. So I'm kind of encouraged that people are waking up, but I want more people to wake up. My little YouTube channel had 5,000 subs. I interviewed these two doctors. They were struck off immediately. They lost their license. The GMC gave them no time to prepare for their hearing. A 256-page dossier was slammed in their inbox 2 hours before this kangaroo court hearing. And they had their license removed, and then they were denied an appeal. So if anyone wants those interviews, I've got them on video. I'll happily share them with you, Anna. I love your work. I love the fact you're allowing people a voice. And I encourage everyone to keep sharing these little testimonials because they speak volumes. I'm more than happy to send these interviews to people. Just send me an email, robin3108@protonmail.com, and I'll use WeTransfer and send you these 4 hours of interviews. Two surgeons struck off in the UK. So Anna, keep doing what you're doing. Everyone keep sharing. Let's wake everyone up. We're going to do it. We've just got to keep sharing. Thanks for watching.
So, crikey, that's Robin Campbell, Martin. His email address, robin3108@protonmail.com. He's basically saying that there is a very, very sinister censorship going on here, where doctors are saying things which don't fit in with the official government story. I mean, I'm reminded a little bit of 7/7 and 9/11 here. We've got an official story, and if those professionals start speaking out against it, then the system comes down on them like a ton of bricks.
Well, I think there was quite a lot of opinion in the piece we've just heard there, quite a lot of assertions about matters of fact. I don't really know what exactly the detail of the Breitbart interviews are.
Well, we'll be hearing those in the second hour.
Yeah, well, Breitbart, as you well know.
What I've done from the Breitbart thing is I've just taken because that's for me, is the big news of the week. It's a very interesting press conference, and on Wednesday, all of the platforms took it down after it had got something like 20 million people had seen it, and it was literally a very important viral video. It's all been censored now. I mean, these concerns that these doctors that Robin Campbell's interviewed here are obviously important, aren't they? We know this is happening. It's not confusing. People have not been treated. They've missed surgery. That they've been discharged into care homes without being tested. That there are questions over whether the tests are viable, or whether there are false positives in them. Patients have simply not been seen. And at the end of the day, these doctors should be surely at least be listened to. Instead, they've been struck off. Now, what happens here is it sends an enormous chilling effect throughout the entire profession, where everybody in the Bristol and Bath area that is thinking about speaking to the media is not going to do so.
Well, I look forward to hearing what you've got in the second hour. But, of course, the listenership will know Breitbart is an alt-right website. Very pushy by people like Steve Bannon, tend to be very pro-Trump. Now, that doesn't mean they're wrong, Tony, but don't just presume that because people say this, Breitbart are saying this over here, RT is saying something over there,
you've missed the point completely, because this is not Breitbart, this is Robin Campbell, who's an IT consultant from Bristol.
Okay, but he's going to use Breitbart later.
One of the tiny things we are going to be talking about, he mentioned there, was this doctor's thing, but that's not what we're talking about here at all. We're talking about these two Bristol and Bath doctors who believe many things that the public are getting, the information the public are getting, is simply not true. In fact, just before I went off to New Zealand in the lockdown, we had an item, didn't we, if you remember, on the show where there was a doctor in the middle of BBC's question time who stood up and said, actually, she didn't stand up, she was sitting down. She was in the front row of the audience, and she said, I'm getting some really good information from the NHS on this and from the government, but the media is the problem. The media is not giving us the right information, and it's actually scaring people unnecessarily. Effectively, I suppose that's what he's saying here, is that we've got enormous censorship going on here in the media.
Well, you'll understand that because it's treated as a public emergency, Tony, there is definitely a public relations strategy by the government in relation to what's going on. It would be the same. It was the same in the Falklands War, but certainly the Cobra has been meeting several times. So you've got a deliberate attempt. They're paying PR people to decide the strategy. Now, there's plenty of critique of what's gone on. My goodness me, I mean, Britain's basically been one of the places where COVID has been dealt with the most incompetence in the world. And there's plenty of criticisms to be made. But, of course, in actual fact, there's loads and loads of different criticisms, and they often pull in different directions.
Well, one of the main criticisms, Martin...
There isn't just one...
Martin, one of the main criticisms is this idea that we had to clear the decks of the whole of the National Health Service to wait for... these tens of thousands of COVID patients, and that has resulted in lots of people dying unnecessarily who were discharged, not only through them not being treated because they're not in hospital to be treated, and but also the knock-on effect in care homes. So if you're then discharged into a care home, you're potentially spreading the virus there. So that's a particularly awful side of all of this. But let's have a look at the figures, because we had some figures last week out about the number of people who, it was in the Telegraph, it was leaked, a government report saying that the lockdown itself is likely to actually kill something like 200,000 people over the 3 or 4 months of the lockdown. So that's an enormous figure compared to the actual registered deaths of 45,000 for COVID-19 included on the death certificate. And of course, that doesn't mean to say the person has died of COVID-19. It means they probably, certainly the technical term would be they died with COVID-19. So it may be they had all sorts of other conditions as well. So the actual total of people that COVID-19 itself has killed is likely to be a lot less than the 45,000. And yet we're being told in a secret government report that's been leaked by the Telegraph that 200,000 have been killed by the lockdown.
Yeah, well, you'll see that not 200,000 haven't been killed by lockdown in New Zealand. They locked down early.
No, I'm talking about here, Martin.
No, I'm just saying the comparison between this country and other countries. The lockdown here was too late, which is why you've got a higher figure.
Martin, we have this discussion every week.
We do, yeah.
Yes, because the situation here in Britain is completely different.
We locked down too late. That's why it's different.
Well, it's because it was spreading in Britain in December and January and February.
And of course,
Martin, you're just diverting from the question. Here in Britain, we had roughly 3 months of circulation of the virus before March. New Zealand didn't. That's the difference.
Yeah, well, and of course, Hong Kong and Vietnam and Kuala also did very well. We've done rather badly. And there's all sorts of reasons for that. And there's going to have to be an inquiry into all of this. And it will be things like the release of people into care homes. Clearly wrong, stupid, maybe heads should roll. And, of course, lots of questions are going to have to be asked. And, of course, the idea that there's just one media narrative, main media narrative, and then on the other side there's all the truth-tellers who are being censored. I would say to you that, in actual fact, there's loads of disinformation here.
I think you're right, yeah.
There's all sorts
of
disinformation.
So 45,000 official COVID deaths versus 200,000 lockdown deaths. You haven't really addressed that one.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, but the problem is, if you didn't have a lockdown, maybe you would have had 200,000 lockdown deaths. So in other words, it's a trade-off, but it's a horrible trade-off. And what you really need to do is get on top of it quickly. It started in Wuhan, and the Chinese Communist Party jumped straight on it. They've had less than 4,000 deaths.
Can we just try and go to the origin of this problem here, though? Because much of it seems to be based on this guy, Neil Ferguson, who, he didn't resign, he was kicked out, didn't he, with his model back in March, where he said that something like 500,000 people in Britain were going to die because of the virus.
Yes, and of course that will have to be there will be questions asked about that.
Yeah, and then he revised it down, didn't he, by about 10%.
All right, but that's because let's try and be a bit.
Was he scaremongering?
Well, listen, what's going on here is we don't actually know what's going on.
He was funded by Bill Gates.
Yes, of course
he's
funded by Bill Gates, but of course if it was started by Bill Gates and they're trying to the idea that there's so much going on here that people are not picking up on. The real question is it a bioweapon? And of course the Chinese Communist Party treated it as if it was a bioweapon from the get-go. Now, if it is a bioweapon, the idea that lots of people could die from it and you've got to take some serious precautions kicks in quite quickly, doesn't it? Chinese Communist Party, they kick straight in. Vietnamese Communist Party, straight in.
But Martin,
the Kerala Communist Party, straight in.
So
in this country, mess around, smack.
Remember,
you're in a different position.
December, January and February of 2019, 2020, I don't think anybody in the world knew what COVID-19 was, did they?
Well, what happened in November, as you well know, as the Times of Israel has said.
Maybe the intelligence services.
Yes, the Israeli Defense Forces were told by the American Defense Intelligence Agency that there was going to be a pandemic coming out of China. Now, that suggests foreknowledge. Foreknowledge by military operators. And, of course, people huffing and puffing about, we've got the wrong problem here, it's just a flu and all the rest. It's not necessarily just a flu. That's why everybody's been treating it so seriously.
I don't think it is a flu.
No, it's not a flu.
Nobody would, I think, in their right mind would say it's a flu. Mortality rate is something roughly around about the same as
we don't really know what it is.
And, of course, that's another major problem here.
This question about biowarfare and biolabs, we're going to come to that in a minute.
People were being treated for the wrong thing. That certainly seems to be the case. Anyway, today we've had an announcement from Boris Johnson about halting plans to ease the restrictions in England. So there were going to be all sorts of things, and I think Boris is going to talk about that now. The various things that we're going to open up tomorrow, Saturday, the 1st of August. Now, they're not.
On Saturday, the 1st of August, you'll remember we had hoped to reopen in England a number of the higher risk settings that had remained closed. And today, I'm afraid we're postponing those changes for at least a fortnight. That means until the 15th of August at the earliest, casinos, bowling alleys, skating rinks and the remaining close contact services must remain closed. Indoor performances will not resume. Pilots of larger crowds in sports venues and conference centres will not take place, and wedding receptions of up to 30 people will not be permitted. But ceremonies, of course, can continue to take place in line with COVID secure guidelines. And I know that the steps that we're taking will be a real blow to many people, to everyone, obviously, whose wedding plans have been disrupted or who cannot now celebrate Eid in the way that they would wish. And I'm really, really sorry about that, but we simply cannot take the risk. We will, of course, study the data carefully and move forward with our intention to open up as soon as we possibly can. 2 weeks ago, I also said that from tomorrow, the government would give employers more discretion over how employees can work safely, whether by continuing to work from home or attending a COVID-secure workplace. And we know that employers have gone to huge lengths to make workplaces safe, so that guidance remains unchanged. We also said that we would pause shielding nationally from the 1st of August, based on clinical advice, and that national pause will proceed as planned, and our medical experts will be explaining more about that decision and about the shielded group later today. Most people in this country are following the rules and doing their best to control the virus. But we must keep our discipline and our focus, and we cannot be complacent. I've asked the Home Secretary to work with the police and others to ensure the rules which are already in place are properly enforced. That means local authorities acting to close down premises and cancel events which are not following COVID-secure guidance, and it means a greater police presence to ensure face coverings are being worn where this is required by law. We will also extend the requirement to wear a face covering to other indoor settings where you're likely to come into contact with people you do not normally meet, such as museums, galleries, cinemas, and places of worship. We now recommend face coverings are worn in these settings, and this will become enforceable in law from the 8th of August. At this stage, we're not changing the rules on social contact nationally. I don't want to tell people to spend less time with their friends. But unless people follow the rules and behave safely, we may need to go further.
Almost ending with a threat there, Martin. So, you know, if you don't do as I say, we may have to go further. Why is it that as the pandemic is conking out, if it ever was really a pandemic all over the world, I suppose, it was in generally around April time, but it certainly doesn't seem to be in the UK anymore, seems to have mostly burnt out. So why are we having even more draconian restrictions being brought in now, which may have been much more appropriate, say, back in March?
Well, it's because they should have been done back in March, and now they're making up for it by doing them far too late, and they're basically facing both ways. I don't think you can presume that you know that it's all going to go away.
Well, okay, so here we go again. Let's put I'll put the graph up of where it's going at the moment. You really have to just take one look at the graph to see that the pandemic is finished. I mean, it's bumping along the bottom. We've had the release of the lockdown, and there has been no second spike.
Well, if you're right,
then or second wave.
Well, then if you're right, well, that's fine. But you can see what the government are doing. It's belt and braces at the minimum. Of course, they've done loads of things
wrong. Is it anything to do with the supply of masks, for example? Because managed to supply lots of masks that weren't available right at the beginning of it, of back in March, at roughly 10 times the original price. And now they're now available.
No, I think what it is to do with is they want the economy to function. But to get the economy to function, you've got to have people going to the shops, but then they're going to spread the virus unless you make them wear masks. What they perhaps should have done is stuck to lockdown. They should have locked down earlier, as other countries did, and then you can actually, in New Zealand, everybody can go to watch the rugby and go to the pub, no problem. It's just foreigners coming in and out that they've got to watch. We're an island. We could have done that. We didn't.
Well, I know, and so is New Zealand. And speaking to people when I was there, they were very concerned that the idea was going to be in New Zealand that no one was going to be allowed to catch this, not even people who weren't vulnerable to it, and that New Zealand was going to be used as an example to the world to force vaccination. In fact, that's where I heard...
There isn't a vaccine, Tony.
Well, when the vaccine comes, we're talking about...
Will there be one?
Obviously, yes.
Will there be?
Yes.
You sure about that?
Yes, I would say definitely. Well, there's about 50 different vaccines. 50 different vaccines being tried.
None of them have worked so far.
Well, it's...
Because colds are very hard to vaccinate against.
It's a little bit early days, yeah? So when the vaccine does come, if the vaccine... Well, let's go round Martin's direction there. If the vaccine comes, almost certainly when the vaccine comes, in New Zealand, they were very concerned that they were being set up basically for a mandatory vaccination.
Well, the issue with mandatory
and a kind of Übermensch and Untermensch. So people who are have been vaccinated will be allowed to have normal lives. Everyone else will be under the thumb.
Well, when we get to that point, the question of mandatory vaccination is a very big question.
If we get to that point,
I think the main thing is, you know, what got rid of SARS and so on in the past is basically they squashed it at birth, and then if you do that, it's dead. Smallpox no longer exists apart from in laboratories, and in actual fact, that is what should have happened. It didn't happen because the Chinese basically, to begin with, faffed around, and then when they got on it, and by that stage, everybody else, including Britain, had basically lost the plot.
Well, I'm hoping
which
next
is why
week,
we're in the situation
I'm
we're in.
I'm hoping next week to have an interview with Dr. Judith Brown to explain these different types of vaccines that they're working at, because they're certainly not like the successful cowpox vaccine that led to the end of smallpox, Martin. This is a technology which is getting into things like nanotechnology and gene altering. So in fact, your entire body, possibly the genes in every chromosomes in every cell, could be altered with a vaccine.
Yes, and of course
this is human genetic engineering.
There's been a lot of question marks about the vaccine industry for years. Those question marks are obviously raising to those who are suspicious of vaccines are very much banging the drum that we don't want compulsory vaccines. But let's come back to what I think is more fundamental. There may be no viable vaccine. In actual fact, we may have to defeat this virus or whatever it is, bioweapon, by using military tactics.
Okay, and I'll post another link to it then to the graph which shows that it has been defeated just by
all right, well, I mean, I'm not going to argue with you, Tony. We shall see.
Okay,
what may happen by the end of the year is we get a massive second spike.
What about this idea of social distancing? Because that's, along with the masks that have been introduced this week, is one of the main planks of the, apparently, you know, to stop the spread, even though it does seem to have spread around quite a lot in the UK over the last 6 months, actually. And Dr. Vernon Coleman, one of your favourite people, Martin, had this to say, and it'd be interesting to get your reaction to it, about social distancing.
The one thing that's doing more harm than anything else at the moment is social distancing. The lunatics who are now running the asylum are insisting that we'll have to retain social distancing forever. In my view, anyone who says this is an ignorant, crypt-orchid poltroon who should be locked up for everyone's safety. The type of social distancing being forced on us is, to use that well-known medical phrase, total bollocks. I'll explain why in a minute. It's social distancing which is destroying lives and which will destroy businesses and everything else which makes our world good. Social distancing forces friends to shout to one another across the street and prevents grannies hugging their grandkids. Social distancing makes people fearful, it breeds distrust, suspicion, and even hatred. Passers-by step to one side and walk on the road, risking certain death if they see someone coming. Social distancing will prevent meetings and demonstrations. It's difficult to think of a business which won't be adversely affected by social distancing. Restaurants are told they'll have to throw out three quarters of their tables, and then try to make a profit. Airlines have to throw out a third of their seats and then try to make a profit. Sports arenas can only seat people if they have 6 feet of space all around them. Cinemas and theatres will have to close off most of their seating. Cafes and pubs have no chance. Commercial kitchens will be non-viable. Most kitchens will accommodate only one chef. Who's going to tell the bloke in the big white hat that he has to do the washing up? Hotels are doomed by social distancing. Can you imagine trying to get back to your room after breakfast? I'm afraid there's a one-hour queue for the lift, sir. We're only allowed to put two people at a time in the lift. The theory behind social distancing is that it will protect people from other folk who sneeze or cough. But I think that whoever thought this up is a cretin. And I think that the people who are implementing social distancing are also cretins. Not because they didn't think through the social or economic implications, although that was bad enough, but because a sneeze doesn't stop at 6 feet. And nor does a cough. A cough can spread droplets for 18 feet, and a sneeze can travel 24 feet. So, if we're going to have social distancing, they've got the distance wrong. It has to be at least 24 feet, and really it ought to be 30 feet to be safe. A 6 feet limit is arbitrary and pointless. If we're going to do this properly, social distancing has to be 30 feet. Now, I suppose there are probably waiters who can serve feet from 6 feet away. But how many waiters can serve food from 30 feet away? How many people can you get in a bus or a railway carriage if everyone has to be 30 feet from everyone else? If there's a driver on a bus, the passenger will have to run behind. It's stupid. And that's why they didn't introduce social distancing that was of any value. They introduced enough social distancing to bug life, but not enough to do any good. The sensible solution is to push our so-called leaders into forgetting about social distancing completely and to teach people good manners, to encourage everyone to cover their mouths and noses if they sneeze or cough, and to encourage everyone to wash their hands frequently. All quite simple, really. Thanks for watching and listening. Actually, the listening is, as usual, far more important than the watching, and I'm one of the disposable generation. A very big thank you to all of you who have left kind messages. Much appreciated.
So he's really having a dig at this whole thing of social distancing, Martin. I mean, he does use imperial measurements, which is, obviously from that generation. But he's really saying that if social distancing is going to be any real use, it needs to be 10 metres.
Well, if you think back to the actual lockdown, people were supposed to be in their houses. They weren't supposed to be going to the shops. They weren't supposed to be going out anywhere, and that's what was going on. That's what was going on. Yeah. So, in other words, during the actual lockdown, people stayed at home, and of course, when you actually go out, you've got to have social distancing. Maybe we should have stuck with the lockdown, where we really were keeping people safe in their homes,
so they couldn't go out and buy food.
Well, no, but in that case, you've got to find a way to deal with
so
that.
So you think everyone should have been locked down 100%?
No, well, I'm just saying that the problem with social distancing on transport and all the rest of it only comes when you release the lockdown. Now, in actual fact, if you're going to have a lockdown, in Wuhan, they had a proper lockdown. They locked down the whole city, millions of people. Everybody stayed
at home. Well, surely it's an either or. You know, surely if you're going out to do some shopping in the time before your social, you know, your lockdown is finished, you should be social distancing, and we had to
well,
then
what,
too.
Well, what they were doing in Wuhan is people who were testing positive were being taken away to be away from their families, so they couldn't spread it to their families. There's all sorts of things you can do and should do to deal with epidemics. We've known about it since the Middle Ages, before we even knew about microbiology.
Yeah, and one thing we've never done, ever, in the history of the world, is to lock down people who are healthy.
No, you certainly you don't know whether they're healthy or not. That's the problem.
If they, well, that's the same in all past cases too.
But
if someone is not, if someone has no symptoms, why are they treated as if they're a sick person?
Well, it depends, because of course there's asymptomatic treatment.
I mean, one of the things that seems to be almost impossible to get through to the government is the idea that there are two different categories of person, one who is vulnerable and one who is not, and that you should treat the two differently.
Well, a 9-year-old girl died in Florida last week.
One.
Yes.
Yes.
If it was your 9-year-old girl...
Yeah, but you don't make entire policy on one person in 7 billion people,
do you?
No, you
don't. And you don't make entire policy on people sitting in their armchairs like Dr. Coleman there when the Chinese Communist Party intelligence services think it's a biowarfare attack.
It's nothing to do with that.
Martin, what does he know about things like that?
It's nothing to do with that. It's about actually stopping spread of a virus. That's all it's about. And he's saying that if you're going to do social distancing, it's going to have to be a lot further.
Well, in actual fact, we should perhaps go back to full-on lockdown.
What, for healthy people?
For everybody, until it's gone. Basically, in New Zealand, it's gone, apart from people bringing it in from outside.
I mean, given that this
that's
is...
what we couldn't
given
that this is and the, in Iceland.
Given that this is the common cold virus, do you think that makes sense to have a lockdown right across the world indefinitely because of the common cold?
Well, no, it's not a common cold, as you well know.
Well, that is the basis of this virus.
It's related to the common cold. The question is, I think the whole idea of herd immunity...
In fact, it's less dangerous. Its mortality is less than the flu.
I think that the whole idea of herd immunity has been debunked, Tony.
What, in Sweden?
No, everywhere. There is no herd immunity to be had from this virus.
Oh, you think you can catch it? You're one of those people that thinks you can catch it again?
Yeah, we don't know, Tony. You don't know, and
We'll be hearing...
If it's a biowarfare weapon, which I suspect it is...
I think this is disinformation, Martin.
It's maybe designed to destroy the economy.
Peddling here, I think, Martin, is just disinformation. The idea that you can't build up any immunity to this, I think, is just simply wrong.
It may be wrong, it may be right, Tony.
Well, why are you saying it?
No, because it's still actually an open question.
It's not.
No,
it's a closed question. Certainly, the doctors have said that you can maybe get tested for it twice, and that may have been a false positive.
All right. Well, to be honest with you, I think that you've got to actually take a step back and think about what this actually is. But all the people who think it's a conspiracy by Gates and all the rest of it—that's possibly
the question.
The
really, is what about these measures? Are they necessary?
I don't know.
Are they more than necessary?
No, the British government basically have got no credibility on this. They've made so many errors at every stage of this that basically nobody's taken any notice of what they say anymore.
Well, you know, that is the nature of a pandemic which is spreading for 3 months before you realise what's going on.
No, they could have done something about it.
If they thought it was the flu.
Well, the politicians didn't know what the hell was going on, but somebody knew. Defence Intelligence Agency tipped off the Israelis. We could have taken, no doubt we were told as well.
Anyway, some of those figures that we were talking about there, I'll put links up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But also, Martin, to sort of round off our first hour, we've got a fascinating story this week about the Labour Party down in Brighton, which, I mean, I hadn't heard anywhere about this, but I saw it shared elsewhere. Apparently, the Labour Party has suspended so many people as part of the anti-Semitism scandal in the Brighton Labour Party that they've handed the city over to the Greens.
Well, I didn't know that, but it's a shocking mess, isn't it?
So the story is in the Argus. I would have thought that would be an interesting national story. But how Labour lost Brighton and Hove City Council this week. In just 2 days, Councillor Nancy Platt's Labour administration has collapsed. On Monday, the party was rocked by resignations from Councillors Kate Knight and Nicole Brennan, both of whom were accused of anti-Semitism. The Greens then became the largest party on Brighton and Hove City Council with 19 seats to Labour's 18. Not even 24 hours later, on Tuesday night, Councillor Platts announced her party would hand over control of the City Council to the Greens, citing failed power-sharing negotiations. Well, of course, the Conservatives and the Greens are not going to make life easy for a party that has basically kicked its own councillors out of the party, leaving the city controlled by another group.
Yeah, well, I mean, the issue here, obviously, is the ongoing struggle over the so-called anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. And... you won't be surprised to learn that I think it's a come on by the Israeli embassy.
But
no doubt I could be suspended from the party for saying that. But there you go.
But what's happening in Brighton is unbelievable, isn't it? That you would actually get rid of people within your own party and therefore lose political power as a result. It just seems to be going a little bit too far.
Well, what you've got at the moment is the right are in the ascendant in the party nationally, and they've basically decided that they're going... I mean, as you know, they settled the court case against the so-called whistleblowers who were Labour Party employees who were sabotaging the last election to prevent Labour from winning. But, of course, now I don't know what's happened about this. I haven't been following it. But Jeremy Corbyn commenting that it was a shame that they were paid and they should have taken it to court... And then John Ware from Panorama saying he was going to sue Jeremy Corbyn. Last I saw, Jeremy Corbyn had something like $300,000 to fight that case. So what may happen is that Starmer thinks he's squashed this whole thing and we're going to move on. And in actual fact, it may well go to the Old Bailey. And just think how embarrassing it will be for Starmer and for the government if Jeremy Corbyn wins that libel case.
But the thing is, they seem to want to do these things, and we don't really seem to care about the consequences. A bit like, we want to kick these people out of the party, and we don't actually care if Labour loses control of Brighton.
The way they'd say it is, it's such a serious issue, anti-Semitism, that we've got to be seen to be taking a stand no matter what. And of course, it is a very serious issue, and therefore, people who are accused wrongly of anti-Semitism are quite rightly outraged, because it's a very serious accusation, and those who use it for political purposes to try and, for example, justify the Israeli government's current belligerent stance on things like the West Bank and Jerusalem, and if they claim that anybody who opposes that is an anti-Semite, that is a scandal. Because ultimately, of course, just like in Bosnia and in other places in the world, we're not going to tolerate racism and we're not going to tolerate land grabbing. And if people say people don't like that, then that's just too bad.
So where is this all heading? I mean, it just seems to me as if anybody that dares speak out in the Labour Party now in support of the Palestinians is liable to be suspended at any time.
Well, if that starts happening, there's going to be an almighty row about it. And, of course, there is going to be an almighty row about it. It's already happening.
This does disable the party, really, as an effective opposition, doesn't it?
It does. And, of course, the we know from the Al Jazeera sting that was carried out on the Labour Party.
Yeah, the lobby, it
was called. That the Israelis say we've got £1 million to spend to make the Labour Party do what we want. And there it all is. It's on the record. The same people that were caught by that sting were also interviewed for John Ware's Panorama programme as disgruntled whistleblowers, when in actual fact they were part of an intelligence scam. And ultimately, that's going to come out in court. And of course, they've got £500 worth of damages now. Maybe if Jeremy Corbyn wins, he's going to get exemplary damages against John Ware. It'll have to be something similar, £500,000, something like that. That should bankrupt him.
Is it going to work its way out, do you think?
Is it going to work its way out?
Yes. I mean, with Keir Starmer in charge, is this actually going to be a solution?
I think what Keir Starmer has tried to do is he's trying to assert himself as being on the right of the party, we're tough on anti-Semitism. But of course, what he could have done is said, well, I'm not going to tolerate anti-Semitism, but we're not going to tolerate this idea that criticising the state of Israel is anti-Semitic. But of course, they've all bought into that by accepting this definition of Holocaust denial or whatever it is, which isn't an internationally recognised definition. It's basically been foisted on the Labour Party. Now, ultimately, of course, this is all going to blow up in their faces when a war with Lebanon breaks out later in the year, and the Labour Party and the Tory government are going to decide whether they're in favour of dropping cluster bombs on civilians in Lebanon or whether criticising that might be construed as anti-Semitic.
OK, so let's finish up. We're looking at the local possibilities of local lockdowns, which our glorious Mayor Marvin Rees is now in charge of. We may have a Bristol lockdown, Martin. You'd be probably pleased to hear that after the coronavirus case rate increases by 55%. Now, this is the testing kits, which we've heard from the Bristol IT consultant Robin Campbell earlier. There's a considerable amount of doubt over how accurate these tests are, with a 55% increase in the case rate. Now, this is not necessarily anybody that's even ill. It's people who test positive for COVID-19. They may have no symptoms whatsoever. So that is a way, apparently, of locking the city down now.
Well,
if it's a tiny number of people, 55%.
Well, we've seen lockdowns in other parts of the country. In Leicester, looks like Oldham. If Bristol's unfortunate enough to have a lockdown, then that's what will happen, isn't it?
But it seems now that there's a twisting of statistics being used in order to lock parts of the country down. Now the pandemic is over.
Well, and you keep saying the pandemic is over, Tony. And
well, as I said, I put the graph up, page at thisweek.org.uk to show the actual levels of deaths are something like 1/100th of what they were at the peak in April.
Okay. I mean, I just basically, when I get on an aeroplane, I trust that I don't know much about aerodynamics, but I trust the people who fly the plane and built the plane to be tested and peer reviewed, and I just get on the plane and it flies, and it's like magic. But when it comes to scientific advice about this, I realise that scientists don't all agree, and there's different views and all the rest of it. But I think it's basically childish to continuously claim that any government statement about anything is essentially malign and based on the desire to make people have a hard time. It may or may not be. That's open to question.
So you don't think that the coronavirus is being used as an excuse to really quell domestic population, to stop having political meetings, to stop having demonstrations?
The coronavirus has been very helpful for bailing out the Wall Street vultures. And of course, that the Wall Street vultures were collapsing. The market was collapsing in September. In November, the Israelis are tipped off there's a pandemic coming. And then when the pandemic arrives, because they didn't take precautions, because they're not going to take precautions, they need it to get into the US system so that they can then bail the banks out for the second time since 2008. That is the conspiracy. And of course, it may well be that they created the pandemic so that they could bail the banks out. That is the sort of thing that the Russian and Chinese intelligence services are looking into. And of course, you've got loads of people over here who just pretend that it's not happening.
What's not happening?
The coronavirus pandemic as part of a plot to bail the banks out and start World War III, Tony.
Yeah, well, yes, but it's happened. That's what I would say, is that the bailout has happened under the cover of the peak of the pandemic.
Yes, so in other words, the COVID-19, if the COVID-19... pandemic hadn't happened, there'd have been a massive bailout of Wall Street in September last year, and everybody would be screaming, why are we bailing Wall Street out again? Now, because there's a
COVID... And in fact, they wouldn't just be doing that, would they? They'd also be saying, we are not going to do it again, and by the way, you're going to separate the casino banking, investment banking, from high street banking, because we don't want everybody's personal savings and businesses all to be sucked in when the casino goes down.
Yeah, well, of course, they had 10 years to sort that out from 2008, and they didn't do it. Now, in other words, it looks very suspicious that this COVID-19 pandemic, whatever it is, because it's certainly good at disrupting things. Maybe it's not the Black Death. It doesn't kill all it comes into contact with, but it does enough to disrupt the economy.
It's even done something to disrupt our loving relationship hasn't it? We're on different sides completely.
No, we don't have to agree, Tony.
No.
We don't have to agree. I've got a different perspective on this than you. I think it probably is a bioweapon. I think it's probably developed by the deep state in the US to smash the Chinese economy
and to allow them
to bail their
banks.
Thing,
it's very much like 9/11, is it's also dividing families. So individuals within families, maybe even a husband and wife, are in the situation where they have very, very different views about the way the lockdown. So it's been a very effective divide and rule tool.
It has, and of course, as you know from the Gladio years, they're quite happy to stir the pot, create social conflict so that the state and the deep state gains more power. And that's ongoing, whether COVID-19 came along or not.
Okay, so this week we've also seen an introduction of a special coronavirus lockdown for Eid. So Muslims are being told, we are targeting you, we don't want you getting together for Eid, and we're going to make sure that you don't enjoy that festival as you were probably hoping to. And that was all announced late last night.
Well, as we heard Boris Johnson earlier, apologising for it. You know, if you're going to have a lockdown for everybody, then it's got to include everybody, hasn't it?
But this is a special one targeted just at Muslims. That's funny, isn't it?
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
He said what Boris Johnson said earlier is, I'm afraid that people are not.
It's not targeted at Eid. It's not targeted at Muslims.
No, what he said was, you're not going to be able to do these various things, and I realise that Muslims are going to be unhappy because it's Eid. He didn't say. He said he was talking there about what do you call it? Gymnasiums. Gymnasiums have nothing to do with it.
No, but this particular thing about restricting gatherings right across the northwest, a lot of people are saying, and I'm saying too, it does seem to be specifically targeted at Eid. I mean, places like Bradford, where, you know, many, many Muslims would otherwise be getting together.
So in other words, what you're suggesting is that the British government has decided to have an intensification of the lockdown in the last 24 hours as a deliberate attempt to frustrate Muslims celebrating Eid.
Yes.
Okay, well, you can say that, Tony. I think it's far-fetched.
Why?
Because they wouldn't
make we've seen Islam targeted right across the world, haven't we?
Yes, but why would, if they were going to do that, why would they? I think they're genuine. They basically said last week we're going to allow these things to go forward. They're saying this week we're not going to allow these things to go forward.
At the last minute, they changed their mind.
Yes, and it suggests to me that they don't know what they're doing. That's what it suggests to me. It doesn't suggest some great master plan.
Well, anyway, I would like to see Eid celebrations go on, and particularly religious services, which are guaranteed by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the European Convention on Human Rights, the European Court on Human Rights, all that sort of thing, carry on. But no, apparently not. Anyway, we're going to be back to talk about the American frontline doctors, the big, big censorship this week that's been going on by the big tech companies, really showing their hand as working in lockstep after some music.